Good afternoon. So last time we started talking about programming with multiple threads in a process. We had dealt with multiple threads before, but they were in separate processes. So we had separate registers and program counters and stacks, like with separate threads, but we also had separate memory, meaning separate global variables, open files, and so on. And we have this other idea of a multi-threaded process. So we have one process which has its own files, its own memory, but has multiple threads in it that all share the global variables, the files, the process ID, and so on. And we looked at the POSIX, the typical Unix API for that. So we saw this pthread create to create a new thread. And once we created the thread, we wanted something equivalent to waiting for the thread, like we did with waitPID, and that was pthread join. And like we saw with waitPID, waitPID collects an exit status. In the case of pthread join, we collect a return value, which is a pointer. And while the thread is running, the thread implementation is going to keep around its own stack, its own registers, its own thread ID, and also just have to keep track of the thread so you can call pthread join later and collect its return value. And this is kind of disappointing if we don't actually care about the thread's return value. Sometimes we just want to do something in the background in our program. And so there's a mechanism to deal with that, which is pthread detach, which is a way of telling the threading library, hey, I don't care when this thread finishes or what it returns. Don't bother me with it. Just get rid of it. And if you don't do this, well, it has to keep it around, just in case you call pthread join. Keep something around. If you call this, it doesn't do that. And we also looked at maybe some more practical things of sort of patterns for passing values to threads. So pthread create gave us this mechanism where we could just pass this one pointer. And that might seem like, well, how can I make a thread do anything with that? You know, I can't. You know, I can run a function, but if I want the functions to do different things, which if we're spawning more than one thread, we probably do. It's not very useful to have two threads doing the exact same thing. It seems like we only need one in that case. We want to pass something. How can we make that work? And we saw several examples where basically we made some sort of data structure, you know, got a pointer to it, passed it to the threads, and because our threads are in the same process, they share the memory, they can access anything in any part of the memory. They, for example, can access something that's on the stack of another thread as long as that thread still is around and hasn't gotten rid of that thing from its stack. They can access something in the heap because it's all the same address space, the same page tables, and therefore the same actual physical bytes. So questions about things we covered last time? Yes? Can I explain the difference between pthread create and fork? Sure. So pthread create creates a new thread. So our new thread is going to have a new stack, registers, and thread ID, but it's going to share, but in the same process, so it's going to share the same sort of heap, global variables, open files. And by share, I mean if we change the heap, if we put something on the heap in one thread, the other threads can access it. If we change a global variable in one thread, the other threads will see that value. If we open a file in one thread, the other threads can open that, can use that file. If we close a file, the other threads won't be able to use that file. Whereas, you know, if we did fork, for comparison, we would have, you know, a new process with a new PID, new heap, new and separate heap, and a new global variables, new files. Now, the new ones would be initially a copy, but if we change them in the new process, they won't change in the original or vice versa. Does that answer your question? So threads have the same PID. So the question is, threads have the same PID? Yes, so the process ID identifies a process, not a thread. If we want to identify a thread, we need a thread ID, which in pthreads is a pthread t. We can get our current thread ID from a function pthread self I didn't show, which is like get pid. Yes?
We have a file and then we fork. Isn't there like some sort of constraint for like
one process can like open and like write a file or something like that?
Question, if I have an open file and I fork, isn't there some sort of constraint that only one process can access the file at a time? No. It turns out, if you read the documentation for POSIX, they do have requirements about what happens if you call, say, write from two different processes at the same time. And basically, those requirements work out to, the OS needs to do the writes in some order. But it's up to the OS how to resolve that, but it's perfectly valid in Unix to have multiple processes open a file at the same time. So note that I said in Unix, some other OSs by default might not work this way. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so brief talk about anonymous feedback. So one question was, what's going on with page table 3 grading? Yes, this is going slower than I thought it would. Apparently, what I thought was fast grading was not fast grading for RTAs, even for the manual part of the grading. We're about 2/3 done. Hopefully, I'll have time to put in some of my own time instead of like putting together auto graders or dealing with conference travel stuff and so on. So we should be done hopefully next week or so. Sorry for the delay. And some, you know, all the feedback is negative. Okay, so we're going to talk about some more topics about threading and sort of our high-level plan. And this is different than what my original plan was, but I'm looking at our upcoming lab next week. So we're first going to talk about locks. So we want to avoid conflicts between threads. We've seen one way of doing this, which was join. And we're going to look at sort of a more general mechanisms to do that. We're going to start with locks, which I think you've kind of seen before in DSA 1. So hopefully we don't have to go over them in much detail. And then we're going to talk a bit about deadlock, which I think you might have seen in DSA 1. We're going to go into a lot more detail about that. And then we're going to talk about ways that are more flexible than locks for coordinating threads. We're going to find some ways some locks are. And oh, one logistical note. So I was editing the reading on synchronization, which some of you may have looked at. And it may have looked awfully short if you looked at it over the past few days. This is because I made a syntax error, and when it converted to HTML, it just truncated it. And I didn't notice. Sorry about that. So let's go back to where we were last time. So last time we mentioned this example here, that we have this sort of what we call the non-deterministic result, that sort of there was this randomness. Now it's not actually random, like something determined whether the operating system scheduled that one thread to print in the thread or not, in that example. It either happened or it didn't, and it probably depended on like, was there something else to run or not? And something that was actually like, you know, not based on like a random number generator. But as far as we're concerned, the sort of conditions around what order things happened in, like we have no real way of predicting it. So they might as well be random. And that's what I mean by non-deterministic, right? Yes, it's probably actually like you could figure out what would happen if you knew all the details of what was going on in the system. But we don't, and when we're writing our program, we don't know all the details of what will be going on in the system, and we don't want to. We want our program to give the right answer, or at least, you know, consistent answers, regardless of what's happening. And that's what we're going to talk about doing. And in this example here, where we're sometimes printing in the thread and sometimes not, it's kind of harmless. But let's talk about sort of a better motivational example. Let's talk about a server to implement, say, ATMs. And this is probably not what you really do, but I have this simple design here. I have this loop where I get a bunch of requests from ATM machines, and if it's a deposit, I do this deposit operation, which gets an account, updates the balance, and saves the account. You know, and let's say that our server has multiple threads. That this server loop is, say, we have a bunch of copies of it running. And why would we do this? Well, we want to take advantage of multiple cores, or maybe this save account updates operation like needs to write to disk, and that's kind of slow, and we want to be able to do multiple of those at a time rather than having us wait for that disk write to finish. But we have some reasons we want to have this sort of design. We're calling deposit twice. So this seems fine, and let's think about what happens if we have two people depositing into the same account from two different ATMs at the same time. And usually, that'll just work. And you might say, well, you know, we got this account object, and I'm just doing this plus equals operation. That's an add, right? An add's one instruction. How could we head into problems? Like, surely we're going to modify that balance in both of the times we're depositing, and there's no problem. But actually, there's likely to be a problem. And to think about that, we should think about, well, what's actually going to happen when we compile this deposit function? And here I have some hypothetical assembly. We take a move from the balance into a temporary variable. We add the amount to that variable, and we move it back. Something a compiler might do. And I have this hypothetical way, even on one core, these two threads that are doing two calls to deposit could run. Thread A runs for a bit, and then it context switches right before it's about to write that back to the balance. Just unfortunate timing. The exception happened right there, and the OS decided, well, thread A's done enough. Time to run thread B. And thread B gets to run for a bit, and then something happens, and the OS decides, oh, time to go back to thread A. And, well, what's the net result here? Well, the final value we have is the one thread B wrote. The one thread B wrote is the original balance plus thread B's amount. Thread A's amount just disappeared. It got written, but we overwrote it. And so now we've lost some money. And if you're implementing this ATM server, people probably would not be very happy about that. So we want to talk more about, like, when is this possible? And one thing that's probably worth thinking about a bit is, like, what's actually possible when we do concurrent operations? So I have an example here, just for thinking about what goes on. And here, I have my thread A is writing 1 to x, my thread B is writing 2 to y. What are the possible values of x? This is not a trick question. This is supposed to be easy. It's the wrong. So I get that, well, only thing modifying x is 1, so it better be 1. It better be the case, we'd be really annoyed if writing to y somehow changed x. And we really hope things are implemented that way. And we really hope things are implemented that way, even if x and y like happen to be next to each other in memory. So how about you? What do you think the possible values of x are? So any, or just give me, anyone give me one? Yes. So it could be 3. So how would we get 3? Okay, so you're saying that we do B's work of doing y becomes 2, and then we do x becomes 2 plus 1, the y, and then we do y equals 2 times 2, which doesn't matter. Okay, any other possible values of x? Yeah. 5? How do we get 5? So your model is that we could have the operations in thread B happen first, and then the operations in thread A. Okay. Any other possibilities? Yeah.
One.
Okay.
That's just the thread A runs first, right?
Okay, so you say thread A runs first, so it gets 0 plus 1 because thread B hasn't run, and then we do all the thread B stuff. Okay, any others? No? Okay. So let's look at this example. What do you think the possible values of X are? Yeah.
1 and 2.
1 and 2, how do you get that? So you're saying, okay, either we do the write of 1 to x or the write of 2 to x last, and whichever one is last, that's the winner. Now I have an alternate proposal. Why not 3? Let's say we write the bits of x one at a time. That's a valid way to write 2 into x, is to write the least significant bit and the second least significant bit. And then they could be interleaved, or we could end with 1, 1. And maybe something similar could happen in this example. We could get 7. So there's some reason why no one thinks that's going to happen. So what's the model people are having when they say, no, this is ridiculous, this shouldn't happen? What do you, yeah?
I think that the processor is not going to context switch in the middle of an assembly instruction.
Okay, so you think the processor is not going to context switch in the middle of an assembly instruction. So I agree, that's a good intuition to have. So, and that works great on a single core. So on a multi-core, we need to be a little more careful, but people with multi-core still don't think this can happen. What's the logic for multi-core why you wouldn't think this makes sense? But I agree, on a single core, it makes really no sense because, well, we know there's one instruction to write to X. We don't do it in a bunch of one-bit instructions. How about with multi-core? Yeah. So your argument is that if you're implementing the move instruction, it wouldn't make any sense to implement it one bit at a time. We're going to do it in bigger chunks. And we talked about caches, which gives you a good reason to think that, right? Caches want to work in really big chunks of data. They don't want to work in little byte bits at a time. So probably that isn't possible. And we're going to have a notion of what we'll call an atomic operation. So something that's an atomic operation is something that happens all together or not at all. That it's not split up into pieces that are done separately. And your intuition is correct that on most processors, loading or storing words, by which I mean naturally sized values, like register sized values, is atomic. Which means that you cannot, in fact, get that 3. That is not a possible answer. And there's some caveats to that. So I have aligned words, basically loading and storing words that don't cross cache lines, that are definitely don't cross cache lines, will be atomic. If they're actually in 2 cache blocks, that might not be atomic. And it makes sense if you think of the hardware implementation. If they're in 2 cache blocks, that might require 2 separate operations to read. It's not going to happen all at once, and you're going to be able to notice that. And if you're thinking of a single core, you'd say, well, surely all instructions are atomic because we can't context switch in the middle of an instruction. But unfortunately, we have to deal with multi-core. And some instructions are not going to be atomic. And we'll see an example of that next. In particular, the example we're going to see is the add instruction is not atomic. Because a complaint some of you might have had about this code here is, gosh, why did my compiler screw this up by not just writing, move amount into RAX and then add RAX into account balance. Why didn't the compiler do this? Because surely this add instruction, you know, it's just going to happen or not happen. We're not going to have it half done. And with a single core, yeah, that would work. But with a multi-core, it doesn't work. And let's look at that. So here, I have written, very carefully, a loop that adds to a global variable called the value a number of times equal to its argument. And I've done this in assembly, making very sure that it's exactly one add instruction, not split up into pieces, that does the add to that global variable. And I run this in two separate threads with a counter of a million. So it's going to try to add 1,000,000 times to the value that is initially going to be 0 from this initialization here. So if that add was atomic, if it happened all at once, we'd expect a result of 2,000,000. And I ran this a whole bunch of times on my desktop, and here is a histogram of the results. 2,000,000 is this dotted red line. So I almost never got 2,000,000. And in fact, not only did I almost never get 2,000,000, I usually got around 1,000,000. So it was usually as if one of the threads did all its adds and then stored that value and ignored what the other thread was doing. And perhaps even more confusingly, I sometimes got results below 1,000,000. And why is this happening? Well, the add to memory instruction, even though it's one instruction, is implemented in the processor with multiple steps. And those steps can be interleaved differently with what other processors or other cores are doing. And this, in fact, really does happen, as we can see from these results. Yes?
Is the reason why they have to take multiple instructions, like small instructions, because it takes, I guess, multiple clock cycles to do the actual adding?
So the question is, the reason why the add takes multiple operations is because it takes multiple clock cycles? That's probably related, but I think the bigger reason why is that this involves a read from a cache and a write to a cache, and those are things that the processor is not really well equipped to do sort of all at once. Okay, other questions? Yeah. What does update loop do? This is a conditional jump to the beginning of the function. Is that what you're referring to? That jump to update loop? Yeah. Yes. How do they mix C and assembly? These are two separate files. I just didn't show the file names. Other questions? Okay. So what is atomic? So loads and stores of words, we said. And if you actually want to find out, if you actually care what's atomic, the processor designers will tell you. You need to check, because you might be surprised sometimes. But they'll generally document what they've made atomic and what they haven't made atomic, and you actually need to check if you're doing that sort of low-level stuff. In practice, as we'll see, we're going to have some higher-level tools that are built on top of the things the processor designers guarantee are atomic, so we can actually kind of reason about our programs. Because it's going to turn out that reasoning about our programs without these tools like this is going to be really annoying. Yes, we could go to the processor manual of what's atomic and do everything that way, but it's really not practical for any non-trivial program. And it might seem like, okay, so the operations are atomic, that's pretty useful, but it turns out that practically speaking, that's not enough to do useful things. Like, it's technically enough in the sense that You can do them, but doing them efficiently with just atomic loads and stores is not really feasible. So to make it convenient for people implementing threading libraries and the like, processors typically provide read, modify, write operations that are atomic. And by read, modify, write, I mean something which reads and modifies and writes a memory location as an atomic operation. So unlike that out I showed you, something that won't be interrupted by some other processor modifying the value, so we'll actually get the sort of it all happened together that we expect. And to give an example, x86 has this instruction called atomic exchange. And this takes a value in memory at the location specified by, in this case, the register. Oh, I should use, I have the 32-bit x86. We'll just, this should be the, we'll do the 64-bit version. So in this case, where RCX is, or ECX, this is, okay, yeah, this is the 32-bit version. And it swaps it with a value in a register. So this is doing a write and a read in one instruction. And importantly, this is guaranteed by the processor maker to be atomic, meaning that no one else is going to change the value in between when we do the write and the read. And you might say, why is this sort of thing useful? Or we'll get to that. But why is this sort of thing easy to implement for the processor? Like, if the processor didn't make the ag work that way, why can't they do this? Why is this some operation that they'll let you do and that's not going to be like horribly inefficient? And sort of the basic implementation technique is that to implement this, you make sure that that piece of memory you're accessing is in your cache and not in any other processor's cache. And processors need the ability to do this just to keep the caches in sync. So like they don't have that ability just to implement these operations, they have it just because the caches need to stay in sync. So they have some way of clearing the value from the other caches. And then they just modify it in the cache and make sure while you did that, no one else got the value into their cache. So that's kind of the basic reason that these can be implemented, is that because we have a way of keeping the caches in sync, we can take advantage of that to ensure that no one else is using the value while we're doing this whole read and write operation. And then let's say, well, how could we use this? So let's say I want to write a function which does something in whatever core gets to this function first. I don't want to do it twice, but I just want to do it once. So what I could do is I could have a global flag which is going to be 0 if no one's gotten to it, and I'm going to set to 1 if someone has gotten to it. But I'm not going to set it to 1 by just doing global flag equals 1. Instead, I'm going to exchange 1 with the flag. And because this is atomic, I know that when that exchange happens, I'm either going to get 0 or 1 back in my value. If I get 0, that means I'm the first, that no one else exchanged yet, because the value was 0 before. If I get 1, that means someone else went before me. And because this is an atomic operation, I know that it's not possible for me to like read the value, someone else writes it, then I write it. Because that's not allowed. The operation happens all at once. So questions about this example here? Yes?
So does that mean that like the time it takes for you to
the question is, what do the, while I'm changing the value from 0 to 1 with this atomic operation, what are the other cores doing? So a simple way of implementing it would be, as you propose, just have the other cores locked out from doing anything. Probably we don't want to do that, because that's inefficient. So we'll just lock out the other cores from accessing this part of memory. And how we would do that is just have the cache figure out, oh, you can't get this cache block until this operation is done. Does that answer your question?
So will they kind of move on to like subsequent operations and then go back and when they get unlocked, or like will they stop if they ever need to go back and then they won't stop and don't need it?
So the question is, will other processors stop if they're waiting for that the memory location to be available. So I guess there's two parts of that. So one thing is that most processors will try to do unrelated operations if they can. And whether they can depends on whether you've on whether they depend on this in some way. And the second part of it is that probably in some cases they would need to wait, yes. But probably there's a limit to how long they could need to wait. And it's probably a very small amount of time. Yes? What do you mean by atomic exchange in the context of read, modify, write? So this instruction exchanges, it swaps my value in global flag. And the reason it's a read, modify, write operation is because it does this by reading global flag and writing global flag in one operation.
So the values of my value in global flag are being swapped each other? Is that what you mean by exchange?
Question, the values of my value in global flag are being swapped to each other? That's what I mean by exchange? Yes. Okay, other questions? Okay. So this is meant, I'm trying to give you an idea of, these are the sorts of low-level tools processors give us to coordinate. And this is a lot more useful than just sort of reads and writes being atomic, which it's actually, you can make this work with only reads and writes being atomic, but it's very annoying. And this is a lot more practical, and this is what the higher level tools we're going to talk about, like locks, are built on top of. Like this is the tool the OS is going to use to coordinate multiple cores so it can implement things like locks. And other things we've seen like pthread join. Questions? Atomic operations. Okay, so next we're going to talk about locks, and I have some definitional things which may or may not be familiar. So there's a concept called mutual exclusion, and for our purposes this means that I should remove my defunct example from here, but this means ensuring only one thread does a particular thing at a time. So for example, you know, only one thread modifies, only one thread modifies the account balance. And we're going to call the piece of code that exactly one thread executes, you'll might see the term critical section for that. And we're going to talk about a sort of abstraction that pthreads and other threading libraries are going to provide to help us achieve mutual exclusion and make some piece of code a critical section, and that's going to be called a lock. And a lock is an object that only one thread can hold at a time. So that's sort of is an object in the sort of object-oriented abstract sense. And the important property is that threads have to take turns doing what we call holding the lock. And we're going to use that to implement this notion of a critical section that threads do one thing at a time, like only one thread accesses the account balance at a time. And probably I should try to talk about locks with an analogy. And you might think, I'm going to use the analogy of like a padlock on something. And I think that's a very bad analogy for locks because it gets you into thinking locks do things they do not do. So my analogy is going to be a hat. So we're going to have an agreement that we're only going to change the account balances in the book when I'm wearing a hat. And I'll keep this hat on the table. And whenever I want to change the account balances, whenever I want to edit them, we have this agreement, so I'm first going to have to grab the hat and put it on. And when I'm done, I put it back. And if you want to grab the hat and it's not on the table, you have to wait for me to take it off. And a key thing to note here is that this is only going to make sure only one person edits the account balances at a time, because we've made this agreement that we're going to put the hat on before we edit those balances. If we don't follow that rule, well, too bad. Two people are editing the balance at the same time, and we've run into problems. And this is how our locks are going to work, that you have to come to an agreement that you're going to get the lock before you do something, and everyone better follow it, or else it won't do anything. It's not like a padlock, where if something's padlocked, you can't access it. It's kind of advisory. It's you have to agree to do it and follow that rule. And our locks are going to have two operations. So we're going to say locking or acquiring the lock. That's going to be putting on that hat. And unlocking or releasing the lock is putting the lock back on the table so someone else can put it on. So questions about sort of what our typical practice for locks is. And so if we're thinking of locks, we're going to have this sort of abstract object that we're going to agree we use before accessing some shared resource, like this account balance. So we're going to lock the lock. And what that will do is if the lock is not locked by anyone, it just gets the lock. If it is locked by someone, it's going to wait until it is available and then get it. And there's an unlock operation which will release the lock and let someone who's waiting for it get it. So our typical pattern is that, let's say we want to manipulate the balance, we're going to get this lock first, do all our stuff with the balance, unlock the lock. That's going to make sure no one else does it in between, and if they're trying to do it, they're just going to wait first until we're done, and then they'll get their chance. Yes?
When you unlock, if there's like multiple people like waiting for the lock, would there be like a queue or like a certain order?
So the question is, when we unlock, if there's multiple people waiting, who gets it? And this is entirely up to the implementation, and there's lots of variety in what will happen. Probably, ideally, you'd like it to be the case that you know, the choice is made in some kind of fair way, where if you've been waiting a while, you're more likely to go. But in practice, maybe not, or maybe so. Other questions? Yeah. Could I go over the difference between mutual exclusion and critical section? So mutual exclusion is, the idea is the property we're ensuring that only one thread does things at the same time. Critical section is the name for the piece of code that is run with that property. Does that answer your question?
Wait, can you explain critical section again?
So mutual exclusion is the property that only one thread does something at a time. And critical section is the name for the code that has that property. That has the property that only one thread does it at a time. Other questions? Okay. So one thing which comes up here is we have this waiting operation on our lock. That if the lock is taken by someone else, we're going to wait. And ideally, with the more nice lock implementations, that hopefully we can wait without using the processor. And this is a case where we're going to hopefully have some help from our OS in implementing our locks, that if we would have to wait a while instead, we'd like the OS to switch to something else and at least not have that processor be wasted, assuming there's something else to run. So we've talked about the lock sort of interface abstractly, and pthreads provides locks, and this is the interface for them. So there's the locks that we're going to care about are provided with this thing called a mutex. Mutex stands for sort of mutual exclusion. It's a particular kind of lock, but it's the main one you're going to end up using if you're using pthreads. And we have to initialize these locks. The most common way you'll do it is by calling this pthread mutex init function. I have this null parameter. This is going to be sort of mutex attributes, you know, which are settings for how the mutex works. I'm passing null, so I'm just using the default settings, but there are some other settings you can set that we mostly won't talk about. And an alternative is if you want to make like a global variable that's a lock, there's this special constant pthread mutex initializer you can use to set one up sort of at compile time instead of calling pthread mutex init. And once we have that set up, there's a lock function and an unlock function. Questions? Yes? Can I give some examples of attributes? So mutexes can be marked as error checking, in which case they will try to find situations where they're misused and give you a return value from lock or unlock telling you that. The default is not to do that because it would be slow. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so here I have some code, and my question for you is, what are the possible values of 1, 2, after thread A and thread B run, presumably in separate threads, simultaneously? These two functions, we start one pthread create for each of them and run them potentially at the same time. What are the possible values of 1 and 2? Question?
So we're going to have two
pthread
mutexes instead of
like, I have two locks, it's like I have two hats? Yes. And somehow I can wear both of them if I want to. Question or answer?
Oh, okay.
Okay, yeah. Who would like to give me a possibility? Okay.
So it could be both one in thread A and two in thread A.
Okay, so you think one possibility is one in thread A and two in A. Okay, how would that happen?
So thread B locks both one and two, and then it unlocks in thread A.
Okay, and a way this could happen is that we run B1, B2 before even A1 and A2 got to do anything. Maybe A starts early, thread A starts at the same time, but you know it needs to acquire the lock and it just waits until everything's done. Okay, other possibilities? Yeah.
One in thread B, two in thread A.
So you said one in B, 2 and A. So how could this happen?
Thread A locks 1, sets 1 to thread A, unlocks, thread B runs, sets 1 in thread B, 2 in thread B, then A finishes for 2 in thread A.
Okay, so your order is that we run A1, then we run B1, B2, and then A2. And the way we might think about this is that A1 runs, and that lets B1 run. And then let's say we've tried to start A2 here. The earliest A2 can run can either run before B1 or after B2. It can't run in between. So you said A2 ends up running at the end. So there's one more possibility. At least, yes. 1 in A,
and 2 in A.
So you say we want to get 1 in A, 1 in A, 2 in B. So how do we do that?
So B1 locks, and then B1 runs.
Okay.
And then B2 will also run.
Yep.
But then when you unlock once, oh, I
Okay, so you're saying you wanted to say B1 runs, and then A does some stuff, and then B2 runs. Right, that's what you wanted to do. And that would be indeed a way we could achieve this sort of idea. But the problem is that in this point in time here, lock one is locked. And that means that if thread A is trying to run there, it can't. It has to wait in order to get to A1. So this is, in fact, not possible. And the way we can see that is that if we ever try to have, that we would want to have A1 run in between B1 and B2, and we can't do that because of the locks. Questions on this idea? Yes.
What is the point of the lock B2? If it's already locked in lock 1, what does the second lock do?
Question, what does the second lock do? So your question is, like, let's say I just remove lock 2 from thread B, all the lock 2 calls. Would that change anything? Anyone have a proposal for something that would change? Yeah. Yeah, so we'll go through examples. So let's say we got rid of this lock here and this lock here. Now, it's possible for A2 can now run any time in the middle of B1 and B2. So previously, we'd have to do A1, and then we could say do B1, B2, and if A2 was going to run, it would have to run either, I guess, it could run here, or it could run here. So I think the outcomes are the same, assuming changing the string is atomic. Right, so these were possible before. But what's now possible is now A2 can run at the same time as B2. So is that any different? Well, if we assume changing the string is an atomic operation, no. If it's not, like if we're actually copying to change the string, then it would be different, right? Because we could have like one of those mixed answers like we saw with writing bit by bit. If we're writing the string byte by byte, we get a mixed answer. But assuming it's just changing a pointer, and assuming that's atomic, then there wouldn't be a problem. That. So the question is, would A skip?
Yeah, so say B1 got locked. It realizes it can't do the A1 operation, so it does an unrelated object and does A2 instead.
So the question is, would we do, if B1's running, would we skip to A2? No. We always go in order. So in this example, to make this happen, we do A1 before B1 gets to run. And how that would happen is, let's say, you know, this lock's just slightly beforehand. B1 then probably starts at roughly the same time, but it's waiting for the lock.
Right,
yes?
So would you say that you need a lock for each variable that we're writing to?
Question, would I say that you need a lock for each global variable that you're writing to? The rule I would recommend following is that you should not have two threads that could possibly, where one thread could be writing and the other could be reading or writing the same value.
Okay, so a lock for each.
So, so that's the rule I would recommend following, is that you should make sure that it's not possible for one thread to write a value while another thread might be reading or writing it. You can achieve that with just one lock, right? If you always lock a single lock before modifying anything, that'll be enough. But you might want to have more locks so more threads can do things at the same time. Other questions? Yeah.
I think before you erased A2, right now you're saying, like, for that other example, you said A2 because we're on the same time as B2 without the second lock.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, with the locks, you said that A2 happened between B1 and B2.
bumps like a little bit.
So your question is, I told you that this is possible.
Yeah, I thought as soon as B1 runs, it immediately locks up B2. So I thought like B1 and B2 were like a package deal, basically.
Question is, you thought B1 and B2 were a package deal. So you're sort of saying, oh gosh, we hold lock one for all of the time B is running. Doesn't that mean that nothing else can happen between B1 and B2? And the answer is, no, the only thing that can happen is something else can't get lock one. So if we don't want lock one, we can do whatever we want. And in this case, A2 doesn't care about lock one. So it can run any time. So in the original code, it can run any time over here, and that's fine. And let's say it does get to run, and let's say it takes a while. Well, what's going to happen is we're going to be locking lock two here. And let's say A2 is running, and A2 keeps running. Well, in that case, we're going to be waiting for a long time, but have a lock held. Lock one held. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
Is there a waiting operation implicit inside these functions that a lock is already locked inside another thread, then it will just keep waiting until it's
so the question, is there a waiting operation where if a lock's already locked, we'll just keep waiting until it's available to be locked? Yes, because that's just how the lock operation works. It waits. Part of what it does is wait. Often, there's nothing to wait for, but that's the first thing it does is wait until it's free. Wait until the lock's available. Yes? Is there anything to prevent a thread from never unlocking a lock? No. Other questions? Okay. So the key thing to reason about, you know, sort of what can happen in this sort of situation is to remember, well, you know, we can think of things happening in some order, but the locks are going to restrict what can happen at the same time. And basically, if you want to get a lock, you need to wait for someone to either, you know, not have the lock by releasing it, or hopefully that they haven't acquired the lock yet. One other thing about mutexes that I'm going to just mention, because some people like trying to do it, there's a rule with how pthread mutexes work that you have to unlock a lock in the same thread you locked it in. Most people don't even think of doing this. I'm just mentioning it in case you do. Sorry, pthread spoils your fun. There are some types of locks where this is possible, not pthread mutexes. So we have mutexes, and this is a way of coordinating threads, and a good question to have might be, is this enough? Like, is this the only thing we need to make sure threads, you know, we don't have problems like that account balance problem, and that threads can coordinate in general? And the answer is, well, there's some things we want to do where mutexes really don't work. So one example is talking about implementing pipes. So we saw pipes are a way where you can write to one end of a pipe and read from another. And the way they work is when you read, it waits until there's something to read. When the OS is implementing that, it needs some way for you to wait for something to be readable. And locks don't really allow us to do that. We can wait for someone to release the lock, but we can't wait for someone else to do something very easily. Like, maybe we can make some locks work somehow for this, but there's not really a good mechanism to wait for something. Oh, and I have here. So we're going to talk about one special type of thing that we're going to use in an upcoming assignment, and we're going to talk about more of these later on, probably next week, that provide sort of more flexibility for waiting for things than locks do. So locks let us wait for someone to be done with this sort of critical section, but often we want to wait for some other condition. And barriers are going to be a special tool for waiting for a very particular type of thing. And I'm going to motivate barriers with this example of, you know, computing a sum across multiple threads. So like the examples we saw for passing values. So let's say I went to some 100 million items. Now how am I going to do that? I'm going to have two threads, each of which are going to sum 50 million items. And then we're going to wait for them all to finish and take the minimum. And we saw a way of waiting for them to finish by joining the threads. But let's say you don't want to start a thread every time. You just want to have threads lying around that will do this, give us a sum, and move on to doing the next summing, rather than starting a new set of threads every time. So there's an API for something called a barrier, which is going to provide two operations and is going to help us do this kind of thing. We're going to initialize the barrier, and we're going to specify how many threads we have. Then we're going to have a wait operation that's going to wait until all the threads have called wait. So in this design, all the threads are going to wait for each other. So how might we use this? In this case, I'm taking the minimum of all the elements. So I'm going to take the minimum of the first 50 million, the minimum of the second 50 million, and the two threads. I'll call wait, and this wait operation will make sure neither of the threads moves on until both have gotten to it. Why both? Because I specified there are exactly two when I initialized it. So questions about this wait operation here? Yes?
Is there a reason why you specify a number instead of giving it like a list of thread IDs?
Question, is there a reason why I specify a number instead of getting a list of thread IDs? Just because it's simpler, but we could have an API yet where we give a list of the IDs we expect. Yeah?
And is it ever used to say, like, I want at least two? If you had, say, like, three threads, and you're like, I just need, like, would you ever use it like a threshold scenario?
So the question is, can I, instead of waiting for all the threads, can I use this to wait for some of the threads? So you could try to do that, but as we'll see with talking more about how barriers work when we call wait more than one time, that's not going to work out very well. You'll want to do something different, and we'll talk next week about ways you could construct what you're proposing, waiting for, you know, the first three in some nice way next week. Yes? What's the argument in barrier initialized? That's the number of threads that we expect to wait. So this seems kind of boring here, right? Because this is basically just doing stuff I could do with pthread join, probably easier. But barriers have this property that they can be reused. Because a very common pattern that comes up is that we'll want to do a computation with multiple threads that has multiple steps. So one example of this might be if you're doing a simulation. So let's say you're trying to simulate the weather. What you might do is you might divide up the world into multiple regions and assign a thread to each of them. And to compute what's going to happen, in you're predicting the weather to be in, you know, two time steps away, you'll use the results from one time step away in the region and everything around it. So what you want to do is you want to wait for everyone to compute the first time step, then have everyone compute the second time step, then have everyone to compute the third time step, and so on. So rather than just waiting for everyone to compute one thing and then you're done, we'll have this scenario where we wait everyone to compute one thing, then compute the next thing, then compute the next thing, and so on. And barriers are reusable, so we can use them in this kind of scenario, that we can call wait multiple times, and each time they'll wait for the next set of threads waiting. And everyone will wait for each other, and in this scenario, that's really important, because thread 1 needs to wait for thread 0 to finish. And similarly, thread 0 needs to wait for thread 1 to finish in order to compute these things. And that's also true in our second case, that thread 1 needs to wait for thread 0 to finish, and, or I should do here, thread 0 needs to wait for thread 1. So everyone needs to wait for everyone else, and barriers with this reusable wait API provide sort of the perfect interface for that. And this is not a coincidence, because this kind of pattern comes up all the time, and it's why barriers work the way they do. Because it's a really common programming pattern, including one we'll have in the life assignment that's coming up. So questions about how barriers work? Yes. So the question is, if I only weighted conditionally, isn't it possible for the weights to become desynchronized? Yes. So to use barriers, you must call weight in lockstep from all the threads. You cannot decide, I initialized the barrier with 3 threads, but I'm only going to use 2. That will not work and will cause weird failures. Does that answer your question? Okay, so POSIX provides barriers, and the API for that, it looks like this. So we have an init operation, which takes a barrier object to init, and the number of threads we want, and also some attributes. Again, you can look up what they are. I don't actually remember, but in case you want to change something about how the barrier works. And there's a wait operation. And as I mentioned, we're going to have an upcoming homework, which is the life homework, where basically you have a grid, and you're doing this. The serial code just goes through the grid for every time step up to a number and computes a new value from the old value at that point, and then we swap the from and the to. And your goal is going to be to parallelize this, and your code is going to kind of abstractly look a lot like this, that you're going to divide the grid up into pieces, compute each piece separately, and use barriers to make sure you wait for all the values to be ready for the next step of the computation. Questions? Yes?
When you have the barrier weights on each side of the thread, I mean, in the example, they're going to be like parallel. But when you're...
So the question is, like, why do we have to wait anyways, since they seem to be... So in this example, all the threads are doing the same code because that's typically how barriers are used, but that's not required, actually. So like thread 0 and thread 1 could run very different code, and the barrier wait operation would still be wait for everyone else to get to wait. Does that answer your concern? I'm just showing, the same code for all the threads because typically that's what it looks like in practice. Okay. So we're going to talk later about things beyond locks and barriers for coordinating threads. And there's 2 big tools we're going to talk about that are much more general. So barriers are like kind of very specific, and locks are pretty specific. And we're going to have 2 tools which you can do to do pretty much any kind of coordination between threads. You know, if you want to wait for 2 threads to be ready, you can do that. If you want to wait for 2 threads to be ready and 1 to have moved on to the next step, you can do all sorts of things you want to do to coordinate between threads with these. And they're going to be something called monitors and condition variables and something called semaphores. And the big thing they're going to add is they're going to add the ability to wait for some arbitrary event to happen. That's really hard to do with locks. So we'll talk about those next week. In the meanwhile, I'm going to first do a little interlude to talk about why you probably shouldn't try to construct these synchronization constructs yourself without doing a lot more research. And one particular problem that happens when people, that where things that seem like they should work don't work because things are more complicated than I kind of let on. So one idea is we went to wait for an event. So here's some code which looks like it should work. So here, I'm waiting for an event, so I'm going to just wait for a flag to be true by doing a loop that checks the value of the flag. And I have a function which sets the flag. It seems like this should work, except that it wastes processor time. And you might say, OK, the things we're going to learn later, obviously, they're not going to waste processor time. But you might say, this is OK. But it turns out that it also just doesn't work. Like, it doesn't actually wait for ready to be set. It doesn't coordinate what you want to do. So let's talk about why. What is going on that is pretty mean that our compilers and processors are doing that makes this not work? And the first place where we have a problem is the compiler. So when you compile code like this, here's some code my compiler generated with optimizations on. The compiler decided, OK, I'm going to load ready into EAX, and then I'm going to test whether EAX is 0. And if it is, I'm just going to go back to the loop. Great work. Just implementing the loop without checking the memory. You just loaded the value once, and the compiler said, gosh, you know, I don't need to read that value more times. How could it have changed? There's no code that changes ready here. You might say, wait a moment, but there's other threads. Well, the compiler, by default, compiles code as if there's not other threads. So it's going to do things like this unless you somehow tell it not to. And there's other things which can go on which are a little weird. So here, let's say I want to have some code here where I've done something extra. And I just want to set this as waiting flag so I can tell if someone's in this loop. And look at what my compiler did here. It decided it's going to set as waiting to 0 at the end. Well, that's normal. But it also decided it's never going to set as waiting to 1. You might say, why did it do that? Well, it said, oh, you're setting as waiting to 1, then to 0. Well, 0 is going to be the final value. I don't need to set it to 1. And again, because the compiler is compiling code by default, assuming there's no other threads around. And you need to do extra work to tell the compiler, hey, there's other threads. I really need this set. Please do that. OK, so you might look at this and say, OK, well, I just need to figure out how to fool my compiler into not doing these optimizations. And you can absolutely do that. So the compiler here has moved around the loads and stores to take advantage of the fact that, well, we don't need to load it every time. We can just do that at the beginning. We don't need to store it every time. We can just do it at the end. And yeah, you can tell the compiler not to do these optimizations, but that still isn't enough. And this is not intuitive, because you'll say, well, if the assembly code loads the variable every time, surely that's just going to work. And the problem is that when we've told you that processors run the instructions in the order in your program, that's not entirely true. So here, I have a little example. I have two thread functions here that I've written in assembly. Thread A here stores one into the global variable x and returns the global variable y. Thread B stores one into the global variable y and returns the global variable x. And when we run these, what results do we expect? Well, let's say we run A, then B. We expect A to return 0, because Y will be 0 initially, and B to return 1, because it runs after X is set to 1. And we expect the opposite, A to be 1, B to be 0, if we run thread B and then thread A. And occasionally, we expect to run the first line of thread A, and then the lines of thread B, and then the last line of thread A, and get two ones. So it seems like those are our possibilities. And that depending on exactly how these two threads are run, that will get some mix of them. So I run this, and here are the results I got. I ran this 100 million times. And here are the frequencies at which it got. So most of the time, A executed first, probably because I started it first. And I got sometimes B executed first. And occasionally, they got interleaved, like I told you. So we got two ones. And sometimes, I got two zeros, which seems like it shouldn't be possible. And this is not a bug in my processor, this is documented behavior. And what's happening is the processor looked at this assembly code and said, gosh, why should I wait to store that value into X? I can just get Y faster and execute this code faster. So it does that. So the processor, in fact, does that load before the store, lets that load happen before the store is complete because it's faster. And because they figure you probably don't care. Because most of the time, you don't. Most of the time, this just makes your program faster, doesn't affect the results. It would be kind of inconvenient if the processor needed to always worry about what if some other thread is accessing this value that seems unrelated to the one I'm loading. So they don't worry about that. And they document in the manual that this will happen. So you might say, gosh, if processors are doing this, how do I deal with that? And my short answer to you is that the tools pthreads give you have dealt with this. And how have they dealt with this? Well, they tell the compiler all the things about saying, hey, there's other threads here. Please don't do those optimizations that will break things because of the other threads. And they also use extra instructions the processor will interpret to say, hey, don't move this load here around this lock here. This lock really needs to have the loads after it happen after it, not before it. So they'll handle those details for you. You could do them yourself, but you should look up how are they doing that if you need to handle this situation manually. Some questions about this reordering scenario? So our next topic is going to be about deadlock. And as a motivational example for deadlock, I'm going to talk about abridging. And I have a simple locking strategy for having these two cars across the bridge. And what we're going to do is we're going to acquire a lock on the segment of road in front of us, and we're going to agree that we're going to acquire that lock before we move there. So first, we're going to acquire a lock on the segment of road in front of us. Then we're going to move forward. Great. And now we have a problem, because our next procedure is that the yellow car, well, we're going to try to acquire a lock on the segment of road in front of us. Oh, that's locked. And the other car is going to say, the black car is going to say, oh, I need to acquire a lock on the segment of road in front of me. And that's locked. So no one's going to make progress. Now, in real life, we probably wouldn't just stop here and keep waiting for the segment of road in front of us to come out. But if we've written code that says lock the next segment of road, that's what we're doing. We're just gonna wait here forever. And this situation is called deadlock, that we're both waiting for each other to release something that we both, that either of us have. Now this situation seems kind of contrived. It is. So let's look at a more realistic scenario. So let's say I represent a directory here. I have a lock for every directory, and I have a hash map of the files. And I want to move one file to another, so I acquire the lock on the directory I'm moving from and to, and then I modify the hash map to move the files. You know, do a hash map get and put to move the files, and then I unlock. This can have the same deadlock problem. So normally, you know, things will work out great. But sometimes, we'll get into this scenario, where they interleave exactly just right. So we lock A in thread one, we lock B in thread two. In this case, I'm moving a file from A to B and a file from B to A. And then we try to lock B in thread one, and that needs, well, thread two to finish. And thread two is trying to lock A, and that needs thread one to finish. And no one makes progress. There's nothing to stop this. So next time we're going to talk about, well, how do we make sure we don't get into this situation or fix the problem if we do get into this situation?